Good morning. It's good to see you guys. So Vern asked me to fill in for him today, as we and I'm going to fight with this microphone, so apologize for that. As we wrap up our series on stories, and take a look at one more of the familiar Bible stories that we've been kind of working our way through this summer. This is the last one. Next Sunday, we're going to take a look at, begin a new series called You Asked For It, and we'll be thinking about questions that many of you have posed. First one being, why bother with the church? And why be a part of the church at all? So we're going to give some time to think about that. That's a really important question. And so we're going to kick off the fall with that, ASU students welcoming them back. Some of you are probably already here, and it's good to see you. And we'll be at over in the sanctuary at 11. Vern and I will be tag team preaching again. I told him we need a high rope so that we can jump off the high rope and tag each other in. That would be awesome. But we're not going to do that. One of the dangers of the stories, these familiar stories, is that they're familiar. We think we know it, right? And so when we begin to hear it, we just sort of turn it off and say, yeah, I know that one. Or we draw conclusions about it before we let it have its way with us. We named this story the parable of the prodigal son, which means we think we know what it's about. And it is about a son who's a prodigal, but it's about more. And so I invite you to hear the story with me. Jesus said, "A certain man had two sons. The younger son said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the inheritance.' And then the father divided his estate between them. Soon afterward, the younger son gathered everything together, took a trip to a foreign land, and wasted his wealth through extravagant living. When he had used up his resources, a severe food shortage arose in that country, and he began to be in need. And he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he longed to eat his fill from what the pigs ate, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have more than enough food? But here I am, starving to death. I'll get up and go to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Take me on as one of your hired hands.' So he got up and he went to his father. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was moved with compassion. And his father ran to him and hugged him and kissed him. And then his son said, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his fingers, sandals on his feet. Fetch the fattened calf and slaughter it. We must celebrate with feasting, because this son of mine was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field. Coming in from the field, he approached the house, heard music and dancing, called one of the servants over and asked him what was going on. And the servant replied, 'Your brother has arrived and your father has slaughtered the fattened calf, because he received his son back safe and sound.' Then the older brother was furious and didn't want to enter in, but his father came out and begged him. He answered his father, 'Look, I've served you all these years and I never disobeyed your instruction, yet you've never given me as much as a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours returned after gobbling up your estate on prostitutes, you slaughtered the fattened calf for him.' Then his father said, 'Son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and now is alive. He was lost and is found. Let us pray. O God, help us to hear your word anew. May this story become our story. Fill us with your grace. Whether we are older or younger brothers or sisters, fill us with your grace. Amen. I want you to note how Jesus begins the story. He says, a certain man had two sons. It's not, hey, there was this younger son, or once upon a time there was an older brother. It's a certain man had two sons. And these boys were different. There was the older brother, the older son. He was the typical oldest child, nose to the grindstone, hardworking, loyal, keeper of the family name. Maybe you relate to him. He knew that the family would literally fall apart if it was not for him. All his life he'd played by the rules, done the right thing, kept up appearances. Maybe you can relate to that brother. Your parents are proud of you, grateful for you. They don't lie in bed at night worrying about your future. The father, Jesus said, had a son like you. And then there's the kid brother, who, we'll just say, marched to the beat of a different drummer. He heard a different song in his head. Mom and dad stay up pretty much every night worrying about his future. And the older brother, most of his life has wanted to throttle younger brother because he can see the day coming when mom and dad aren't around anymore and I'm going to have to take care of the little, you know what. So a certain father had two sons. And one day the youngest son came to him and said, Dad, whatever inheritance is coming to me, and in that day it would have been about a third of his father's property, whatever inheritance is coming to me, I'd like to have it now. There's some things I'd like to do before I have to settle down, so whatever portion of your wealth that I'm supposed to get, could you give it to me today? If you've ever had someone you love deeply really disappoint you, I mean, that's the sting of this request. Dad, I had hoped that you'd be dead by now. But since you aren't, could you just give me my money anyway? The shame of a child saying that to a father in that culture, for one thing, it just wouldn't happen. Kenneth Bailey has written about the nature of such a request, and he says he's gone all over the ancient Near East asking people if something like this could actually happen in their culture, village to village, questioning people from the Sudan to Turkey to India to Morocco. And the conversation, he says, has typically gone like this. Has anyone in your village ever made such a request of a parent? Well, never, is the answer. Well, could anyone make such a request of a parent? Well, no, that's impossible. What if someone did make a request like this? Well, the father probably would have beaten the you-know-what out of them. Well, why? Well, because it would have meant that they were wishing their father dead. I'd rather have the money than you, Dad. I'd rather have the money than you. It's cold. It's about as heartless as you can get. Luke says it didn't take him long to run through his portion of the family wealth. Various translations put it differently, but they all say something like he's guilty of dissolute and extravagant living. Not sure what that is, but I imagine it's kind of like freshman year of college, something like that. Dissolute and extravagant living. If any of you, by the way, are freshmen in college, just disregard that last statement and do what your parents tell you to do. This is worse than the servants who took their wealth and buried it in the ground because they were afraid of what the master would do, while the others invested it wisely. I mean, this kid has blown the whole thing. Threw it all away. This gift of the Father's love, he's wasted it. It is all gone. He has nothing. He's come to nothing. He's alone. He's left to make a living in whatever kind of menial, profane way that he can. He's worse than the servants who serve his father's estate. It's nobody's fault but his own. He had it coming. You might say he deserved it. So he's miserable. He's at rock bottom. As Fred Craddock used to say, there is a condition worse than death, and that is being lost. I don't know if you've ever seen anyone who is truly lost, but it's not pretty. So he decides he'll crawl home to dad. Maybe Pops will at least give him a servant's job, a roof over his head, something to eat. Rehearses an apology. Must have been a pitiful sight standing there on the doorstep. Begins to plead his case, but before he can even really finish the apology, his dad's already hugging him, embracing him, kissing him. Tears are flowing. Heart is filled with joy and gratitude. He starts ordering around all the servants, hey, go get a robe and a ring and some shoes. Let's kill the best calf we have. Open the best bottles of wine. Let's have a feast and a party to welcome him home. This is a parable of love and forgiveness and extravagant grace and joy. It's an image of the kingdom, of the strange economy of God in which we apparently get what we don't deserve, where hospitality comes to folks like Zacchaeus and even sinful sons. It's a beautiful, beautiful scene. It is also quite maddening. It is not fair at all. If you're counting, and some of us are counters, this kind of thing doesn't add up. I mean, where is the real apology? He barely gets a word out, and dad is already throwing a party. I mean, where is the penance? The evidence that you're sorry for what you've done. Where is the parental speech that should have accompanied this story? Something like, hey, you can come home, but the trust thing, we got to work on that. You're going to have to earn your way back. I mean, it's almost as if the father, by not demanding more from this son, is condoning his horrible behavior. I mean, let the kid come home, that's fine. But as Fred Craddock says, let him come home to water and bread, not to a feast. Let him come home to sackcloth, ashes, not to a robe and a ring. Let him come home in tears, not in dancing and partying and joy and merriment. I mean, who welcomes sinners like that? If you look, I think it's up there. Yeah. This is Rembrandt's portrayal of the prodigal. There in the shadows, you can just see him. You can make him out over to the side. That's the older brother. And I can tell you, this is precisely what he was thinking and feeling. What do you mean, party? I mean, all these years and you never did this for me, and this son of yours, how dare he come home calling and this way, expecting to be forgiven and loved and just welcomed with open arms? That blessing belongs to people like me. Right? If he knew anything to be true, he knew this. Because the older brother had been keeping score and he was winning. He had earned his relationship with his father. And how dare this little brother claim it? There were some religious people listening to Jesus that day when he told this story. Like in the story of Zacchaeus, they were older brothers and sisters, to be sure. And they were certain that the world does not work like this, like the image Jesus has just envisioned. And a lot of us are too. It seems as if somehow we've stumbled into a world where two and two no longer equal four. We older siblings were pretty sure that these are not the rules that we're to play by. This is not the script we were given for life. And so all of these older brothers and sisters, the good religious folk listening to Jesus, they're so offended by God's grace that they miss the party. Remember last week, Zacchaeus? There were folks who wouldn't come to dinner in Zacchaeus' home. And today, at a homecoming feast, the brothers standing outside, so offended by God's grace that they stand outside in the shadows with their arms crossed, grumbling under their breath, refusing to come inside and take the seat at the table that is theirs. There's a seat right there for them. It's been there all along. When was the last time you were so offended by God's grace? And it is offensive because it calls into question all of our ideas about who is deserving and who is not. It reveals our hope, a hope that we like to keep hidden away in the dark, that there just might be some people beyond the reaches of God's embrace. And if God doesn't love them, well, then that means I don't have to love them either. And when grace ceases to be offensive, if we reduce it to sentimentality and to manners, if we no longer feel the costliness of it, the way it cuts, then we're no longer dealing with the grace of a crucified God. The truth is, the inheritance, the grace, the mercy, the forgiveness, the love, they were the Father's to give all along, however and whenever the Father chooses. Even when by our metrics, it seems wasteful and unfair. Because it is precisely at the moment that God's grace and love are wasteful and unfair that we have hope. Because it is only by the wasteful, extravagant, unfair, unexplainable mercy and grace of God that any of us, older or younger siblings alike, have any hope at all of sharing life with God. It is all a gift, and absolutely none of it adds up. And when we lose sight of that truth, then we find ourselves lost in some distant country. Tim Keller says, "The truth is, neither of these sons loved the Father for himself. They were both using their father for their own self-interests rather than loving, enjoying, and serving their father for his own sake." And this means, and this is really the point, that you can rebel against God and be alienated from God by breaking all the rules and by keeping them all. You can avoid Jesus as Savior by being really religious. Because when we do that, we think we have some right to God. God owes me answered prayers, a good life, ticket to heaven. God owes us because we're the older brothers and sisters. We've stayed at home. We've done the right things. We've been to church. We sat on a committee. I went to seminary, for goodness sake. I could have had a real job. God, you owe me, right? You owe me. And the thoughts then of God giving to those people, those little brothers and sisters, whomever they are, what belongs to me? Well, you end up standing outside, missing the party. Jesus said a certain father had two sons, and all he had ever done was love them. And all he ever really wanted was to have everybody at home around the table together. Have a feast to break bread, to tell some stories, to laugh, to cry, to drink a little wine. Some won't come because they can't possibly believe that there's a seat for people like them. There's just too much guilt and shame. And others, they won't come because they don't think they need to. They've got this thing figured out, right? Or they've seen the guest list, and kid brother's name is on it. And I'm not coming if he's coming. Friends, the table is set. The feast is prepared. And the amazing thing is, the Father is still waiting. It's mind-boggling to me, knowing who I am and the sometimes darkness in my heart, that there's a seat here for the likes of me. There's a seat here for the people that I really struggle to love and really don't like and wish that God had not invited. There's a seat here for you. If you're an older brother and you've lived well, thank God. And there's a place at the table for you. If you're a younger sibling and you've kind of, well, you know, made a mess of things, or you tend to do that more often than not, and you've had to come, you know, home begging your way back in regularly, there's a seat here for you too, and everyone in between. Now, this is Jesus' table, and He's the host, and every one of us are His guests. And so He invites you to come and meet the Father. Let Him embrace you and forgive you and give you His peace. Will you pray with me?